You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 75 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
Hello.
We have got, let's get right into the beer that we have this week, because we have a lot of things to toast.
We do.
So in continuing with our all Fremont fresh hop ales, we've got not a Fremont Field to Ferment ale. We have a different Fremont fresh hop ale. It's fresh hop season.
It is.
And this
one
is
one of my favorite seasons. Actually, I don't know that I like fresh hop season that much, although I like the fresh hops. I just like prefer when it's summer.
You know, fresh hop season could be like June. That'd be great. It would really pull June together.
It would.
But so what we have here with us for it only comes out one time per year, and that is the Fremont Koichi Canyon fresh hop ale.
So this is made with the best Koichi Canyon fresh hop ale is brewed from select organic hops grown in the Koichi Canyon of the Yakima Valley, which are harvested and placed in our kettle within 24 hours, creating a unique once-a-year beer. We make Koichi Canyon ale in partnership with Hop Growing Wizards from the Yakima Valley in an effort to expand the organic hop industry in Washington State because organic hops matter. A portion of all sales fund the Koichi Canyon Conservancy.
Wow, look at that.
So there you go.
It's almost like this is the Field of Ferment before Field of Ferment. They made this, people were like, oh, Koichi Canyon is excellent.
This is even more like geo-targeted than Field to Ferment.
It's like this is the Koichi Canyon hop version of Field to Ferment.
Very much so.
I'm curious to see if it tastes differently. So we have to first toast to some things that are coming.
Well, first off, we are now inside 1 week to Peltoncast host Seattle Sports Trivia at the Runaway at Numo's next Tuesday night, October 10th.
We need to write some questions.
I've already written several questions.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, did you expect to be involved with that? Well, I just assumed I was doing that whole thing.
The answer is Gerald Patio to every single one, right?
So I think someone joked about that on Twitter. Have I talked about Gerald Patio that much lately?
You should be. You're probably not talking about it because you don't want to give away the answer.
That's a great point.
The only answer. What can people expect from these questions? What are we talking here?
Well, first off, I think at some point I have to write a Seattle Thunderbirds question because of the fact that they were
in, there needs to be one
in the picture on the website.
The answer is going to be Showwear Center to that one.
So far I've gone with a few different categories. There's going to be a graphical category. Who am I? I forget what other categories I came up with, but there's some other ones in there. Yeah.
Okay. I'm excited.
And it's a variety. It's all Seattle sports, you know, franchises and all eras. You know, I want to, it's going to be like you'd have to have a breadth of knowledge about Seattle sports to do well here.
How would you fare at this?
There was probably at least one question where I was like, I'm not sure if I would have gotten that if I hadn't looked it up. I might have gotten that wrong. I'm pretty good at this, which is why I'm writing the questions.
And that's why I'm not doing anything. That's why I'm just reading them. So what you can expect is a night of fun at the Runaway with the Fabulous Peltoncast. Questions about Seattle sports from all teams, from all decades. A chance to win prizes from the Runaway, a bar tab there.
Yes.
Plus a chance to be the third Pelton brother on, I guess, next week's episode of the Peltoncast?
Well,
2 weeks from now?
Probably 2 weeks, because next week I think we'll be recording after that show, possibly, like the night of it. So that's a pretty quick turnaround.
We're just going to record it live right there.
Also, and this is a place we went on Sunday in a slightly different version, a chance to eat from the Paseo that is now located in the Numo's complex.
Plus Paseo. The Paseo sandwich I had on Sunday was excellent.
My Paseo sandwich was great. Is in the corn, too. You guys missed out with not getting the corn.
You're always in on the corn. I'm not in on the corn as you are. I feel like I need to bring a bag of burgers to throw at people again.
All right, you're paying for it this time. I'm good on that.
You've paid for enough burgers.
I've paid for plenty of burgers.
Well, I can't wait for that. Don't count on there being burgers. There might be. I might just eat them all myself.
Also, I think that Numo's would probably not be excited about that because, again, they are trying to sell.
Yes, the Paseo sandwiches, which are excellent, by the way. Excellent Paseo sandwiches.
Yeah, I've
had the Numo's once. We should have that beforehand.
That was my plan.
All right, sounds good.
What else are we toasting?
Well, we were pouring one out.
Yes.
We're too close to actually pouring one out there.
Yeah. to the late, great Tom Petty.
I just want to say a quick something about Tom Petty. You know, he's not somebody who, growing up as a classic rock fan that I was through my high school years, right? Calendar year 1999 through 2004 or so. Tom Petty was never somebody who I treated as like a pillar artist, right? He was not Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan to me. But over time, I really came to appreciate what Tom Petty does. And it's like, I was always an album person, and I've never listened to a Tom Petty album. Just not a single time have I listened. I've turned on Damn the Torpedoes or whatever, Full Moon Fever, not once. But Tom Petty has one hell of a greatest hits collection.
Yeah.
I mean, I would put it up there with almost anybody. Every single song on the Tom Petty greatest hits, top to bottom, is superb.
I got to say, I was a little surprised at the depth of the emotion on social media the last couple of days. I mean, you often see this when artists die, but I think this is comparable to, you know, what we saw with Bowie, for example, last year. We've lost too many great artists lately, but it's the response for Tom Petty stands up there with anyone.
Well, and the other thought that I had was through this time period, I've been able to see, I feel like, almost all of these pillar artists, you know, people mm-hmm. I've been interested in seeing. I've seen the Rolling Stones a bunch of times, Paul McCartney, Bruce Springsteen multiple times, Bob Dylan. And Tom Petty was playing at, I think, Safeco Field like 6 weeks ago. And I was looking at people who the Lumineers were opening. So there were a bunch of people who I knew who were there. And I was looking at photos from that show and I was like, man, I kind of want to see Tom Petty.
It kind of felt like there was an urgency to go see Tom Petty because, I mean, it felt like he was going to continue touring for a long period of time.
And so also, I mean, I'm sad that I didn't go to that show and see Tom Petty. But also, this is a plea to you if you're somebody who likes to go see shows.
Especially if they're Billions artists.
Yeah. Arcade Fire coming up. Seahawks are on bye. but you can't always wait.
Yeah.
And there's a chance that Tom Petty might go into full cardiac arrest and die that day.
Wow, that got dark. I was also struck by the fact that, you know, I just recently watched The Defiant Ones, the HBO documentary about Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre and their partnership with Interscope Records. And Tom Petty figured prominently in that because of the fact that Jimmy Iovine had produced, I think, an album, two albums of his, I don't know, an extended period of time, certainly, and was very involved. And yeah, I mean, again, just felt very present in our lives right up to the moment when he no longer was.
Yeah.
So,
RIP.
Yeah.
And then one last bit of programming news. You're most likely listening to us on Wednesday. This is October 4th or something.
Yes.
Tonight, we are going to be recording a podcast.
Tonight, we are going to be joining our friends at Beast Pod Productions on the Tasteful Profanity podcast is the joint special guests on this. We're really excited about it.
Cannot wait for that.
And you still have an opportunity, I think, to submit your questions at Seahawks Scout. Mike has been requesting them, and you know, I'm curious to see what the listeners, they may have multiple listeners as opposed to just our listeners. So
what as their opposed listeners to just the listener. Yeah. I'm really cutting loose on that one.
It's fun. We got a chance to meet him and John Fraley, the co-host of that podcast, on Sunday before the Seahawks game. And yeah, very excited to pod with them.
So this is my button-up podcast.
Is it?
Right. That one. Letting it all hang out.
Well, you're going to start swearing probably a lot more. I mean, it is the Tasteful Profanity podcast.
I'm going to start swearing a lot more.
So yeah, that should be a lot of fun.
Really going for a lot of raw emotion. And we might talk music on that one too.
That's the word. Although I don't want to give away too much of our time.
I had an idea. I was actually going to DM this to them, but we can just talk about it on this podcast.
Well, hopefully they'll listen to it beforehand.
I think we do top five Tom Petty songs.
Oh, I like that.
In tribute.
That's a great thought. Yeah. All right. Well, something that was sometimes fun, but not always fun, was the 2017 Seattle Mariners season, which came to an end with a whimper on Sunday. And we decided it would be a good time to look back at the season and Mariners hot takes.
It began as a joke and a denial after opening day.
I am upset about this. I want some hot takes. I want some takes about the Mariners offense is broken.
That might be the case, but it's too early to judge that that's the case. They're playing a very good team.
Since when has that stopped anyone from judging the case?
I'm sorry. This is a different kind of
podcast. It is a different kind of podcast.
I don't have hot takes.
But soon he would. Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Mike Zunino, AAA player. Nelson Cruz, the carriage turned back into a pumpkin. Lefty Grove's record of 31 wins is the minimum for James Paxton. Here is what we're talking about. Cy Young got it, claimed it. It's over. Cy Young is written. We are talking 32 wins, zero ERA for the year. He is on track for it, and it's going to happen.
The up and down nature of the Mariners' season provided ample opportunity for takes both positive and negative.
Going from 2-8 to the best odds of going to the World Series. And do you want to know how they're doing it?
I would love to know how they're doing it.
With what I call the three true outcomes.
Oh. You're aware of the three true outcomes?
Pitching, power, and grit. And I'm going to put on my Dion Waiters Nostradamus hat, and I see not a 5-game win, not a 10-game win streak. This looks like a 20-game-plus win streak right now coming up for the Mariners.
Now, those are pretty common in baseball, right?
They happen all the time. Okay, do you want to hear a list of things that I would rather watch than watch a Mariners game?
Oh, no. I mean, yes, obviously, yes. I want to hear that.
The Confederations Cup.
Okay.
NASCAR.
Really?
Canadian football, which is on a lot right now.
Is it?
That clip of the ferry crash from Grey's Anatomy.
Haven't seen that one.
College basketball!
Oh, wow. Why do we even watch college basketball?
By August, both the Mariners and the Takes were losing steam, and it was time to go to the bullpen.
So when you ask me, would I trade Boog Powell for him? My response is I wouldn't trade the original Boog Powell for him, even though he's good. 75 years old and hasn't played baseball in 4 decades. Because at least Boog Powell makes damn good pit beef at Boog's Barbecue in right field at Camden Yards. And that's more than I can say for Yonder Alonso.
Wow. I might have burned myself.
I think we need a moment to recover from that.
Wow. Those were some hot takes.
Those takes might have been too hot.
At the end of the highs and lows, there was only this. A 16th consecutive season out of the playoffs.
And to the Mariners fans who still think the Mariners have a chance to make the playoffs.
11.5% chances, according to Fangraphs.
Lower after today.
Oh, they lost. Okay.
Yeah, they lost again. Don't worry. It's 4 in a row. You're just being delusional.
Given that lack of success, you might say that to be a Mariners fan is to be delusional. But still, we go on believing that someday, what third Pelton brother Eli Anderson prophesied before the trade deadline will come to pass.
So, a couple years ago when the Mariners were just having the most garbage time, I had to have the conversation with myself that was, the Mariners are never going to go to the World Series, and that's totally okay. And I need to be fine with that. And if I'm going to continue to watch the Mariners and care about them, I need to divorce myself from, like, this is the goal. And the goal sort of became be 500. But over the last few months, seeing what Jerry DePoto has done, I think they're going to get to the World Series next year.
Whoa! That's the hottest take.
So the offseason begins with this final thought. Wait till next year for more Mariners hot takes.
Oh, man, that was great.
Some of those takes were really hot. Sometimes too hot. I don't know if Eli...
Was the Lefty Groves mentioned?
I can't remember.
Hit all the pillars of modern baseball. You got Boog Powell, Lefty Groves.
Which, by the way, the current Boog Powell did produce more war the rest of the season than Yonder Alonso.
It's good that you looked that up.
I did look that up. Do you think Eli would still deliver his Mariners in the World Series next season take? Because I cut out a lot where he was talking about he thought the Mariners were going to make the playoffs this year. It was before the trade deadline when I think like Jerry DePoto's star really lost a lot of its luster in the eyes of Mariners fans.
Oh, man, that was a rough trade deadline. It's good that you took out all of the hot takes pertaining to the trade deadline because they might have been too hot.
I mean, the Yonder Alonso trade is the only specific trade deadline thing I remember doing.
Oh, you forget. Maybe you didn't listen to all of these. I gave through a list of players that the Mariners traded that they later regretted trading, including David Arias.
I didn't
know. And the trades, if we can look back on those trades, who's the lefty pitcher that they got from the Cardinals? He didn't last a single start into the fifth inning,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that one wasn't something I listened to but didn't use. He went to Gonzaga, right? I don't know his name. Uh-oh. How would I know that?
He's
a
baseball player.
I don't know about the Mariners.
Okay. Well, anyway, I look forward to not discussing the Mariners for another how many months? 6 months?
We may discuss some off-season moves. We discussed some occasional off-season moves, and especially if there are hot takes to be had about the 20 Jerry DePoto trades that are about to get lined up over the next 3 months here. Then, you know, we'll break into our regularly scheduled programming for those takes. Marco Gonzalez.
Oh, yeah.
Was that pitcher, by the way.
Should we talk sports?
I suppose the Mariners already started that, but yeah, let's talk sports.
Real sports.
We'll start with the Sonics Arena, where there isn't much new. The only real update, I think, in the past week here is that on Monday, the mayoral candidates in the city of Seattle, Jenny Durkin and Carrie Moon, held an open forum at KEXP, and they were asked about the Key Arena plan, both of them, during this forum. And, you know, both took...
They looked off into the distance.
They both took kind of a cautious stance, I would say. It was not a full-throated endorsement of the Key Arena renovation plan. And one thing both of them brought up that I thought was interesting is that they're wary of a partnership with Live Nation that gives them exclusivity at the renovated Key Arena and would like it to be open to all acts. So
then why is Live Nation renovating Key Arena?
That's the question, is does it pencil out financially if they don't have exclusivity?
They're not renovating it if they don't have exclusivity.
That's a question that remains to be seen. Now, again, the mayoral candidates don't have any specific control over this process, which could be completed by the time they take office in January.
No, is that true that they're taking office in January, though?
I think they still are. I think it's only the city council member that will take their seat, filling the spot currently that was vacated by Tim Burgess when he became the mayor. I think that's only the council member that comes in as soon as the results are validated.
Okay.
So the Seattle City Council is currently seeking a ninth member to fill that spot. Former council member Nick Licata.
No, I'll do it.
You're not a Seattle resident. I mean, I thought about it. I'm not good at meetings, so I seem to, but I also don't live in the city of Seattle. I don't think my heaviest Seattle mailing address.
You're the unofficial mayor of unincorporated King County.
That's what I like to call myself. So Nick Licata, not a favorite of sports fans, but you know, we'll see. He may be in this case. Yeah, he expressed openness, I think, to the Key Arena renovation plan when Jeff Baker, the Seattle Times, asked him and Chris Van Dyke from Citizens for More Important Things, who are two key players in crafting I-91, about whether this arena proposal should be exempt from it. And
yes,
they expressed openness to the proposal and thought that maybe it did meet the spirit of the law. So we'll see how that plays out. And then next Tuesday, as we've discussed, again, coincident with Seattle Sports Trivia that we're hosting, will be the Seattle City Council meeting of the Committee on Civic Arenas, and that will be an opportunity Tuesday night for fans to give their feedback. And really the best opportunity, I think, for anyone who's a fan of the SOTO plan as opposed to the Key Arena renovation plan to go make their voice heard. So what I'm basically
we're going to be the cause.
What I'm basically
we have Paseo. So
what I'm basically saying is you better be at one of those two events.
You're not staying home on Tuesday night. You're not watching the baseball playoffs.
If you're if you don't live in the city of Seattle, probably then you should come to the trivia, because you probably can't make an effective statement on behalf of SoTo Arena. And then, you know, if you're on the fence but live in the city of Seattle, maybe that's who should go to the open city council meeting. So we'll see. I think that meeting will probably engender some more arena talk, because it's been a kind of quiet couple of weeks here, somewhat surprisingly, as we get, you know, as this podcast comes out, it's 2 months from when the city council, when the Office of Economic Development is hoping that they will vote on this proposal on December 4th. So it's coming up.
It's eerily quiet.
And a month until the election.
What about the Sounders? A busy week for them.
Yeah. So first got the release of, after not having won a game in more than a month, a 3-0 win Wednesday at home over the first place Vancouver Whitecaps, the floodgates opening with goals.
That's good.
That is good. But then on Sunday, they went to Philadelphia, and with a makeshift lineup in a game that started at 10 a.m. Seattle time, lost 2-0 to the Philadelphia Union.
That's bad.
That is bad. Here's who the Sounders were missing in that match. They Obviously, Jordan Morris, who has not played since he suffered a hamstring strain, and probably, we'll see whether he is able to return by the end of the regular season, but that's not even certain. Ozzy Alonso left the game on Wednesday with a quad strain, which was the disappointing news out of that. Roman Torres did not play due to knee soreness. Victor Rodriguez, who had a really good game against Vancouver, had to travel back to Spain for the birth of his first child, and congratulations to that. We'll toast to that.
A toast to Victor Rodriguez and his family.
Clint Dempsey did not start with the three matches in 8 days, and Christian Roldan played through two fractures in his left arm.
It's like Rhys Odhiambo.
So Dempsey came in after halftime, and we didn't watch this game because of the fact that we were busy tailgating. But by all accounts, the Sounders really didn't have any offensive attack whatsoever in the first half, when I do not believe they had a shot, period. But then got some chances in the second half and really had a chance to tie this match. They were trailing 1-0 most of the game, but then Philadelphia added a late goal just before the end of regulation time to kind of kill off this game. So where does this leave the Sounders as we head into the international break this week? With the Sounders having the week off, they are still tied for second in the Western Conference on 47 points. But the bad news here is that Sporting Kansas City, one of the other three teams that's tied for second with them, has two games in hand. They've got four games left after the international break, whereas the Sounders, and believe it or not, the MLS regular season is actually drawing near a conclusion after the baseball regular season is already over and done.
The whole climate has changed. I was thinking today, I was like, it's cold. It's October now. Oh, yeah. Soccer's kind of coming to an end.
Yeah. So the Sounders have just two matches remaining after the break, although both of those will be at home. The odds of a first-round bye, according to 538 Soccer Power Index, now down to 20%.
Oh, no.
And the most likely scenario, it looks like, is that the Sounders will probably tie for third with the Portland Timbers, who also have an equivalent number of points and an equivalent number of games. And in that scenario, the Timbers would win that tie because they have an additional win. The Sounders have more points through draws so far this season. So that would leave the Sounders in fourth place in the Western Conference. But still much to be determined as we come back from the international break. Big weekend for the USMNT.
Yeah, speaking of the international break, what is the deal with the USMNT? What is the situation for them?
Well, they're still very likely to qualify for the World Cup. The latest
odds. You keep saying this, and it never feels like they are.
It doesn't feel like it. No, the latest odds that I saw, courtesy of ESPN Soccer Power Index, had them at 83%. To make the World Cup entering this weekend, but a huge swing based on the results of Friday's match against Panama. Courtesy Paul Carr of ESPN's Stats and Info Group, a 93% chance to qualify for the World Cup if they win the match against Panama, independent of the other results. It drops to 62% with a draw and 44% with a loss at home to Panama. So this is a big one.
So this is in the U.S.?
I do not 100% know that, but based on the percentage chances, I'm pretty sure it is. So I can look it up to confirm here. But that seems to be the case.
Do they play any other matches during this break? Just that match against Panama?
I think they will play two of them. So let's see here. Yes. On Friday, hosting Panama in Orlando at Orlando City Stadium. And then the following Tuesday, that same busy October 10th, although before Seattle Sports Trivia. You could even come watch it at the Runaway.
Oh, wow.
If they have beIN Sports, I don't know if everyone has that. The USMNT will be facing Trinidad and Tobago on
If
Tuesday.
Not, you can use my Comcast account.
Well, then you'd have to watch it in Spanish, though.
Oh, beIN en Español.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same. So there you go. And we'll revisit what the Sounders are doing after the break next week. All right, some late breaking news into the Peltoncast news desk.
Wow.
Which is well staffed.
Is there a news desk?
No.
That's your Twitter.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Associated Press reporting Tuesday night that the Seattle Storm will hire Dan Hughes as their new head coach after firing Jenny Busek midseason and having Gary Kloppenberg finish out the season as interim head coach. Dan Hughes, the longtime coach of the San Antonio Stars, who he coached to the WNBA Finals in 2008, where they lost to the Detroit Shock, has coached more games than anyone in WNBA history and is a two-time WNBA Coach of the Year in 2001 and 2007. He originally stepped down as coach of San Antonio in 2010, was trying to scale back to just GM duties, but after a year Collier was asked to come back to the coaching job and return there 2011 through 2016 before retiring at the end of last season after the Stars had spent a couple years in the lottery with a combined 15 wins those last two seasons as head coach.
Okay, so there's probably nobody in the world who is more qualified to answer the question of what they think about Dan Hughes as the head coach of the Seattle Storm than you.
So it's interesting because I think in many ways it's a return to...
Are there Storm questions, by the way, in your trivia?
Yes.
You better be prepared.
Yeah, I mean, it's a breadth of knowledge. That's what I'm going for here. That's what this podcast is all about. So I think it's in many ways a return to what the Storm were trying to do under Brian Agler when he was the head coach here, and obviously very successful run then, including the 2010 WNBA championship. Agler was hired by the Storm in 2008 after he was an assistant to Hughes in San Antonio for a couple years, including 2007 when he had stepped in for a while when Dan Hughes, I believe, ruptured his Achilles and was unable to coach on the sideline. So Agler gets kind of a partial share of that 2007 Coach of the Year award that Dan Hughes won. But, you know, they've got kind of very similar philosophies, defensive-minded. So I think that's really the goal here is to try to improve defensively because you know with Breanna Stewart, as long as Sue Bird is still active and she was just playing with Stewie and Jewel Lloyd at the USW, they don't really call it the USWNT, but the US Women's National Team's mini camp over the weekend. So still full steam ahead for Sue Bird.
Looking like she's going to retire.
No, and Kelsey Plum, I don't know if you saw this today, tweeted that Benjamin Button? I can't remember.
Oh, that was Kelsey Plum who tweeted that?
Yeah.
I saw that tweet, but I didn't realize it was Kelsey Plum who tweeted it.
It was. Let me pull that up here. Sue Bird also won the Sportsmanship Award last week, so congratulations to that. She previously had shared it before, so the second time being honored for sportsmanship in the WNBA. Yeah, Kelsey Plum, I swear, at S10 Bird is the real Benjamin Button. So anyway, as long as you've got that core in place, this will be a good offensive team. And if they can get even to average defensively, which they did in the second half of 2016 when they made their run to the playoffs, then this can be a competitive team. And that's going to be Dan Hughes' assignment.
All right. I've been thinking a little bit about the when we do our Peltoncast year in review about the Sports Star of the Year. And I was thinking Kelsey Plum is a wild card, but I don't know. Her whole WNBA career is really...
That
tweet is bringing it back, though.
Oh, yeah.
Make it a little bit closer. You also sort of broke some news on this podcast last week about the Russell Westbrook signing in Oklahoma.
Yeah, I had some inside info on that one. I didn't want to say too much.
Still, I mean, people, you're getting breaking news here on the Peltoncast. You're basically like you're our own version of Woj. So really quick, we talked too long about the Thunder last week.
Way too long.
But if can you throw your wet blanket on the Thunder on this podcast for us?
Yes, Thunder fans were very unhappy with the timing of my piece.
And we'll be pleased.
Yeah, the back end of that contract looks like it could be really ugly. I mean, there's some concerns about how Russell Westbrook is going to age. He's really reliant on his athleticism.
Has he held out longer than most players who play like Russell Westbrook?
I would say yes. I mean, you do see a lot of...
Do you think there's a difference also in the year that he's playing as opposed to, like, Penny Hardaway is the obvious one?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is injuries, so it's sort of random. So you do see a lot of guys like this who drop off or decline due to injury. And Westbrook, despite that knee injury, the meniscus injury that kept him out of the playoffs in, I want to say, 2013, has generally been able to stay healthy, has not missed a game due to injuries the last couple of years.
Really suffered any sort of significant injury.
I mean, that meniscus injury is pretty significant, but it was a repair instead of a removal when he had it fixed, so that's, you know, better long term. But, you know, as you project forward into his 30s, I think injuries are going to become more of a concern for him. And then there's the question of, you know, if he loses half a step, he's not someone who can shift to relying on his jumper at this point. He'd have to improve a lot to get to that point. So, I mean, I think he'll still be a very good player, but they're going to be paying him $45 million, a projected $45 million in the last year of this contract when he's age 34.
You should see what the Mariners are paying Felix in the future.
Well,
there's no salary cap
and
there.
See how well it's working out for the Mariners. The one concerning thing on the basketball friends this week, our friend of the pod, Black Trey, said he thinks Paul George is re-signing with the Thunder.
Wow. It's before the season started. I've seen all these tweets where they're like, Carmelo and Russell seem to be getting along really well. It's like they haven't played a game together.
Well, they have now played a preseason game together.
But that's not the same, playing a preseason game.
Lost to the Rockets in Tulsa in their opener. who the Rockets made all their threes, which is a good strategy.
It's very early for people like Black Trey to be making that prediction. And for like Paul George is going to get to free agency, and a lot of most players when they get to free agency leave.
I don't know. I don't agree with that.
Yeah, that's it's facts.
No, no.
But then also they like Carmelo and Russell getting along well. We don't know what's going to happen. They haven't played a game yet.
I mean, the thing is, even if they re-sign Paul George, like given Westbrook's age, given Melo's age, this is probably the best they're ever going to be.
Yes,
but it certainly would be. I think that Westbrook extension would look a lot better if they re-signed Paul George.
Interesting. So your argument was, I actually don't even know if I agree with this argument. Your argument was.
It's not that they shouldn't have signed him to the extension. Obviously, they should sign him to the extension.
But that having Russell Westbrook, that their chances of winning a championship right now are like, what, 8%, something lower?
I wouldn't want to put a number on it just off the top of my head. But
you're putting a percentage chance. It's not a number, really.
Yeah, but I haven't investigated it enough to put a number.
So, but right now, they have a small percentage chance of winning a championship. And by re-signing Russell Westbrook, they'll still have that small percentage chance. Or they could bottom out and potentially get a superstar caliber player.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if it's just Westbrook and not Paul George, and even if it's Melo, because at his age, he doesn't really matter long term.
He's basically a role player at this point.
You're locking into being decent, I think. You're locking into being like last year's Thunder team.
Because the difference between drafting a superstar player is you have them for cheap for a long time.
Exactly. I mean, they're paying him 35% of the cap, and it's going to be more than that because of the fact that now, you know, we've had this period where the cap was going up and up and up, and then like long-term contracts were great because they were only going up a little bit, and the cap was going up this huge amount. Now we're going to get back into the world where the cap is only going up a little bit, like, you know, 2% last year, like a projected 5%, or I guess 2%, a projected 5% next year, or I guess it was 5% this year, I projected 2% next year, and it's 8% year-to-year raises on Westbrook's contract. So, you know, by the end of the contract, he could be making 40% of the salary cap.
Man, okay.
So,
all right, well, I feel better about that. I feel like I'm constantly needing to be talked off the edge this offseason.
I mean, it has been a pretty remarkable offseason when you consider where they started.
Should we talk football?
Let's start with Husky football, who had, in many ways, it was a Seahawks-esque first half, where the defense was great.
It was Seahawks-esque second half this week also.
Well, yeah, the two games were very similar. The offense just really could not get it going, seemed stuck in the mud. But then, as I sort of predicted, as soon as the Huskies got up two touchdowns and Oregon State had to throw, it went down. It got ugly in a hurry.
Yes.
And they ended up winning 42-7. The Beavers getting a touchdown late against the Huskies' second unit to avoid the shutout. Huskies still don't jump up a spot in the polls because of the fact that Georgia jumped ahead of them with their blowout win at Tennessee. And so they remain number 6 in both polls, despite number 5 USC losing last week on the Palouse.
Do we have anything to say about this Oregon State game?
It was nice to see LeVon Coleman get going. I think that was exciting to see. I mean, Oregon State's not very good.
Yeah.
The Huskies are very good at football. I mean, the other thing that we probably had, we didn't talk about this last week, was the kicker situation.
Oh.
Where Tristan Vizcaino at this point...
Shaming Tristan's.
Yeah. Missing the extra point, and that was the last we saw of him as a place kicker. I think he continued to kick off, where he's been terrific in that role, but his
he didn't miss the extra point. He hit the extra point really ugly, and then missed two field goals.
Okay.
I think that's right.
All right.
Anyway. Missing an extra point in college is like a feat.
It really is. So Van Soderberg then came in to take over the kicking duties. And certainly you saw the level of faith that Coach Pete had in the kicking game when they went for it on 4th and 10 from the 25.
It was brilliant, though.
I mean, it was the right move. But you probably want to be able to successfully convert a 42-yard field goal at some point. Like it doesn't matter in these games, but there's going to come a time where the Huskies are going to need to be able to make an important kick.
I mean, I kind of like it because it forces Coach Pete to be more aggressive than I think his natural nature is.
His natural nature as opposed to his unnatural nature?
Than Coach Pete's nature is. But it would still be nice to have a kicker.
It would be very nice to have a kicker. All right, so this weekend kind of has the feel of more of the same, with Cal coming to town off a loss to Oregon, dropping them to 3-2 for the late night kickoff, 7:45 p.m. on ESPN this Saturday. The Huskies 27.5-point favorites over Cal and former Husky defensive coordinator Justin Wilcox. So in his first year at the helm at Cal, Wilcox is overseeing a real turnaround defensively. is this his specialty? They last year, according to ESPN Football Power Index efficiency ratings, they were 119th in the country defensively, and there's not that many more than 119 FCS teams or FCS. FPS. No, we are FPS. This year, they are the number 40 defense so far.
Not bad.
In those same
FPI. I love how wildly Cal swung from having a coach who didn't care about defense at all
right.
to having a coach who's almost solely focused on defense.
Which I think they can have an effective offense under Justin Wilcox. They've also got, they hired his offensive coordinator, Bo Baldwin, who was the head coach at Eastern Washington, put together those tremendous attacks.
I was reading a headline where it was like, Bo Baldwin scored 56 points against the Huskies 2 years ago. And I'm like, Bo Baldwin didn't score those points.
I don't know that he scored it. I mean, I give him
Vernon Adams scored those points. Cooper Kupp scored those points.
We'll get to Cooper Kupp in a second here. He turns out he was a big part of it too. Probably the right time for him to leave with Cooper Kupp going to the NFL. But no, I think they'll get it going offensively. A lot of this is personnel. They had Davis Webb starting for them at quarterback last year. He graduated. He was a graduate transfer. They've brought in a first-year starting quarterback in Bothell native Ross Bowers, who is so far completing 55% of his passes, which ranks 11th in the Pac-12, and he is tied for a Pac-12 high 8 interceptions so far in his 204 pass attempts, tied with, of all people,
wow,
Sam Darnold.
Man.
They also lost their leading receiver, Chad Hansen, who declared for the NFL draft, and their second leading receiver, Demetrius Robertson.
You just said declared for the NFL draft. Is he on an NFL team?
Yeah, he was drafted in the fourth round by the Jets.
Okay.
I don't know if
Well,
hey, the Jets are 2-2. Shout out to Jermaine Kearse. They're
the same record as the Seahawks.
Yeah, exactly. Are the Bills 3-1? Is that a thing?
Yeah, Bills are just good.
That didn't occur to me until I was listening to the Simmons podcast today. I was like, wait, oh, they won all those games.
Yeah. And the Patriots should be 1-3. They're 1-3 in my heart.
So really the most effective offensive player for Cal has been running back Patrick Laird, who is averaging 6.2 yards per carry. But yeah, this is not an offense that strikes a ton of fear. And if they get behind, which it seems likely they will, this could get ugly in a hurry. Also, Cal, the number 109 special teams in the country. UW dropped to number 10 last week because of the field goal issues, but still an elite special teams unit that should be able to take advantage, I would say, in this matchup. Despite how well they've played overall on defense, it's really kind of been dependent on turnovers. They're forcing 2.4 per game, the same number as UW so far this season. But the Huskies, of course, have been very good at taking care of the ball. They've averaged just 1.0 turnover of their own per game. Cal, 2.6, which is the second most in the Pac-12.
And turnovers are something that are going to regress highly.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a case where you're going to make regression to the mean work for you if you're forcing a lot of turnovers. In terms of actual like success in the passing game, opponents averaging 7.1 yards per attempt, which ranks 9th out of the 12 Pac-12 teams. So Huskies should be able to find some success through the air.
Yeah, this is not going to be pretty. I mean, so we've seen a couple weeks in a row at Colorado where it felt like in so many situations, Colorado was scared to pass the ball against UW.
Yeah.
And then Oregon State. They were scared to pass the ball.
I mean, Oregon State probably should have been scared to pass the ball.
They should both have been scared to pass the ball. I'm not saying they were wrong to do so, but I mean, it is very impressive considering the young secondary that they are scared to.
Yeah, and the injury there with Byron Murphy, who, I mean, you know, these haven't been the toughest tests, but he hasn't been missed so far.
And then you have a quarterback, a first-year starting quarterback coming in, completing 55% of his passes. Yeah, what are they going to do?
Not great. I mean, they're going to probably try to run the ball.
And that doesn't work that well either. I mean, this is another game. Like, the Huskies have been, I guess I would say, maybe a little bit lucky with their early season schedule. It gets more difficult from here. It
gets a lot more difficult.
But this is another one where it looks eerily similar to the previous two games that they played.
I mean, Colorado seemed much more difficult on paper. It's similar to what Colorado ended up being.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
against the Huskies, though, Colorado looks good. Otherwise, I mean, you know, they went into UCLA. We can continue talking about this. Where does FBI have the Huskies overall?
Well, in terms of the efficiency ratings, which are just this season's performance, the Huskies are number 2 in the country so far.
I mean, it's really hard to look at this team and not see them as one of, let's say, the 5 best teams in the country.
So then when you go to the actual FPI Football Power Index, which also incorporates preseason expectations to account for regression to the mean, UW is 5th in those.
How did they fall? They were in the College Football Playoff last year. It's like I feel like they're being treated like they're a team that doesn't have any sort of history behind them.
Well, I think, you know, you consider multiple years of data when you're doing those preseason projections. And that will be of lower weight by the end of the season. But it's Alabama, Ohio State, which has the loss, obviously, to Oklahoma, who ranks third just behind them, and then Clemson, then UW. So, it's lofty company.
Yes. Fine glass of team to be among. Teams to be among.
Alabama, number one in the team efficiency so far this season. Georgia, just even with the Huskies, tied for number two.
But there's almost no way to look at this and say that the Huskies aren't clearly the elite team in the Pac-12, especially with the loss that USC suffered at Wazoo last week.
And just, I mean, even before that game, USC didn't really drop very much in FPI in that one because of the fact that it looked like a close game, because of the fact that they just weren't as high on USC as the rankings were. They're still at 15th. Stanford now, the second best team in the Pac-12 in FPI, at 14th. Oregon at 17th, although...
Where's Wazoo?
That's going to change with Justin Herbert out of the lineup. And then Wazoo at 22nd.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I mean, Wazoo, despite how fun that win USC was...
They played a close game with Boise State that they should have lost. And then Boise State went on to lose, I think, at home to Virginia?
Yeah, Boise State's not very good. They're 66th right now in FPI. Wow. There was a lot of talk last weekend about, man, wouldn't it be amazing if both the Huskies and the Cougars were undefeated going to the Apple Cup? Crunch the numbers on this one with FPI. It says a 1% chance of happening.
Oh, no.
And I mean,
because Wazoo is almost certainly going to lose, or?
I believe their odds of making it undefeated are 3.3%. They're not favored. They're underdogs both at Oregon next week, although, again, the Herbert injury isn't factored into that. And then, again, at home versus Stanford on November 4th, they're underdogs in that match.
Okay, but if game day comes to Seattle for the Apple Cup, how amazing would that be?
It would be really amazing.
We have to get game day here for at least one game this year.
I mean, it feels like we've actually had game day a little too much lately. I mean,
two times ever.
I know. They're making up for loss.
Two times ever.
But like last year was a little bit of a stretch.
Last year was a little bit of a stretch. We went to the college football playoff. Who are you?
I mean, it just wasn't that exciting of a matchup that they were here for.
UW versus USC wasn't an exciting matchup.
I mean, USC did go on to win the game.
And they won the Rose Bowl. You're talking a college football playoff team all against the Rose Bowl winner, and that's not an exciting matchup for you?
All right, I guess that's all fair.
What does it take to be an exciting matchup?
I guess I'm mostly thinking the fact that it was UW at Utah that they had that game day there. That was a little dubious.
Well, that's not because of us. And they also came here for the last game at Husky Stadium.
Was that it?
Yeah, the Oregon game before then.
Huh, okay.
I think that's right.
I think that was renovated Husky Stadium.
Or maybe it was the first game at renovated Husky Stadium. I don't know.
No, the first game at renovated Husky Stadium was Boise State.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Coach Pete.
Nice win. Anyway.
All right. Well, the Huskies are still good.
Percentage chance of victory?
95.
I guess I'm going to go a little bit higher.
Yeah, I mean, FPI says 96%.
97.5.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I would be very surprised if the Huskies lost this game. I mean, Cal looks like a better team. I would say that Justin Wilcoxon knows the team, but he really doesn't at this point. You know,
no, it's been a long time.
He knows
the team from the standpoint that he's been coaching in the Pac-12. And
he knows Coach Pete and what he does. But also, if that's the case, if you stack these two teams up against each other, the Huskies are better in every single facet of the game, and they'll be very prepared to play it.
I never read that much into the whole, they know the playbook kind of thing.
No. Jeff Tedford knew the playbook pretty well.
All right, let's get some stuff off our chest.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
All right, my grievance is not with anything specific or anyone specific. It's with injuries to Seahawks running backs. Like, seriously. This is 3 years in a row that the Seahawks have had an exciting rookie running back felled by injury, a serious injury. 2 years ago, of course, it was Thomas Rawls coming on strong, I think in the top two or three in DVOA, maybe number one overall among running backs.
Number one.
Is a replacement for the injured Marshawn Lynch at that point, and then he suffers a season-ending injury in the game at Baltimore, I believe.
Yep.
Last year, CJ Procise plays a huge role in the Seahawks winning at New England, is starring again as they won the DVOA Bowl against Philadelphia at home, goes down with an injury at that game. Seahawks offense, never the same. And now we're here again with Chris Carson. Like, this was such an amazing story, Chris Carson, seventh round pick, winning the starting job over Rawls, over Eddie Lacy, over even Procise, and having a great performance all around against Indianapolis until he goes down, and Russell Wilson immediately runs over to him, and you're like, oh no, that can't be good. And it wasn't. And even though the Seahawks are still holding out some hope that he may be able to return this season, it looks like likely a season-ending injury for him after he had ankle surgery. So can you just please give us one? JD, let JD McKissick at least stay healthy, okay? Is that too much to ask? Just the injury gods, give us this one, okay?
Can we stop it with these start times in college football?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
7:45? I mean, that is pushing it farther than you could possibly imagine they would push the start time. 7:30 seemed late already. Because, newsflash, college football games in the Pac-12 season take 4 hours. Halftimes are still 45 minutes in Pac-12 play. But can we quit it with these start times? Like, we wonder why Georgia leapfrogged UW for the number 5 spot. It's because nobody has seen UW play all season long. They're looking at these games. They watch Georgia play 1 o'clock, right? 1 o'clock Eastern, even. And they're destroying Tennessee. They see every second of it. The Huskies beat Colorado 42-7, and it's like it didn't happen. Nobody is seeing these games. I can't blame people for having East Coast bias. I have East Coast bias. On Friday night, the Wazoo versus USC game, I couldn't stay awake till the end of the game.
That is accurate.
I understand. Grievance against myself for being an old man. But like, are you kidding me? It's not just that these games are long, it's that halftime is long and there are reviews that take forever. Everything about it is setting itself up for people to pay more attention to teams that are playing in the Midwest and the East Coast. And then we complain about it. It's like, what? We're doing this to ourselves. Can we not pay attention to games that are like having 3 games at 1 o'clock or 3 o'clock?
I mean, I don't think it's a lack of people paying attention. It's just there are other potential games on then because other conferences play at those times.
So Colorado, what time did that start?
It was 8 p.m. local, 7 p.m. Pacific.
That was 7 here. That was 45 minutes earlier than the game that they're going to play this Saturday. Are you kidding me?
Okay. I mean, here's the thing. First off, I don't know if you've heard, this game will be televised on my employer's network.
Oh, really?
Yes. So let's ease up here.
On the like 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. block? They're not even televising it live. They're just doing the broadcast where they abridge it.
They're not tape delaying. Hey, here's the thing. First off, not a lot of people were watching back when the Pac-10 back in the day was not on ESPN and not on Fox. And those games were being played at earlier times, but no one was watching them because of the fact that they didn't have the channel.
And they're still not watching.
But the Pac-12 is getting a lot more money for it. Here's the other thing, though. People make this out to be a West Coast issue, and in terms of people watching the games, it is. But you do understand that, like, you know,
locking down the Hawaii voters.
You do understand that, like, the marquee game time locally on the East Coast is 8:30 p.m. Like, the college, like, the ESPN Saturday showcase starts at 8. I'm not actually sure what time. I think it's either 8 or 8:30. Like, everywhere college football games start late. That's just a thing. It's not unique to the Pac-12. Because you're going to those games.
The other grievance that I have is where the voters are based. It's like there are 3 voters west of the Mississippi.
Look, my grievance is with people worrying about the college football playoff in September.
Oh, come on.
Because look, if you win out, things are going to take care of themselves.
I agree with you, but it's like there shouldn't be a situation where the Huskies, as a team that has dominated basically every single game that they've played, went to the college football playoff last year where I didn't see Georgia there, and then Georgia leaps in front of them.
I mean, Georgia beat a better opponent. Than the Huskies beat.
We don't know that. How good is Tennessee?
We know that Tennessee is better than Oregon State.
Is Tennessee better than Colorado?
They're an actual Big Five, Power Five conference team. So
is Tennessee better than Colorado?
No, probably not.
Colorado won the Pac-12 South last year.
But that wasn't the game last week.
I was watching the ESPN late night shows after the Husky game. And the number 5 spot for the playoffs.
Remain calm here.
They had TCU. I didn't even know TCU was a good team.
TCU is a good team.
If you would have asked me how many losses TCU had, I would have said 1 or 2. Had TCU ahead of the Huskies. It's like, come on. What do we need to do here? Anyway, it doesn't matter. We'll win our games. It's fine.
TCU has been 5th in team efficiency so far this season, according to Football Power Index.
Still worse than the Huskies.
It is. Look, the Huskies are being penalized for having a bad strength of schedule. And people people are not necessarily trying to pick the five best teams. They're trying to pick the five most deserving teams. And as my friend Dean Oliver will tell you from having done a lot of work on this issue when he was at ESPN.
Name dropping again.
There's a huge difference between the best and the most deserving. And you have to take two totally different approaches to try to quantify those two things. All right. Okay. Can we talk about the Seahawks?
All right. Basketball on paper.
So the good from last week. Number one, Scorigami.
Oh, man.
I'm out of beer here, but a toast to Scorigami.
Love a good Scorigami.
I was very excited. You know, like that was like my main focus during the fourth quarter.
I have to follow that Scorigami.
Actually, that was not my main focus. My main focus was making sure I won my my fantasy matchup with loyal listener Jimmy. I had Jimmy Graham and Doug Baldwin, and he had
how ironic.
He had Chris Carson in the Seahawks defense, and narrowly eked out that victory by I think less than 2 points. That Jimmy Graham catch on third down in the red zone where the Seahawks were inexplicably throwing in that final drive was really terrific. Anyways, got the Scorigami. The offense looked great. The defense looked great. Special teams still didn't look that great, but that's okay. This was the performance we were kind of waiting for.
Well, especially in the second half.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
I mean, I went through and looked at it. I was expecting to see, because I know that their yards per play was really good throughout the game, and I was expecting to look at the box score and it to say, especially the advanced box score that showed how many yards they had per down and things like that. But really, they were excellent in the second half. You know, it's not like it was that illuminating seeing. They were good in the first half. They were probably better than the points that they scored in the first half. But in the second half, they were almost perfect, and especially picking up third downs,
which is so crucial, as we've talked about in the past. It's got an outsized importance on the game.
Picking up third downs and stopping third downs.
But I think there were many things to like. Number one, the increased use of read option, or at least a read option look, even if Russell Wilson isn't actually reading that defender and doesn't have a chance of keeping the ball.
Just still the lack of heavy offense, not even just necessarily Russell Wilson or them showing the read option running from three wide receiver sets. It's the end arounds. It's everything. Yep. It's like little quick flares to JD McKissick. It's running the ball, sure, but running the ball from situations where you're not telegraphing that you're running the ball with a shitty offensive line.
It was interesting because when Eddie Lacy was in the game early, they really frequently went to play action with Eddie Lacy, I think probably to counter that expectation that every time they bring in Eddie Lacy, they're going to hand it to him. Now you're going to have to play Eddie Lacy more, and you're going to have to be more diverse in your offense with him, and him and Thomas Rawls are going to carry a heavy load. But I would like to see both McKissick and CJ ProSize active, assuming that ProSize is
they'll definitely able to be active. Return.
You think it's a guarantee they're going to have all four backs up?
Well, I don't know. CJ ProSize, injury-wise, I don't know if he'll be active. I guess JD McKissick will be active in this game.
I mean, he was incredible. Like, a lot of fans had a lot of hot takes about McKissick during the preseason that did not age well in that game, I would say. But anyways, my thing is, as much as the Seahawks still want to be that power running team and to grind teams down, like the dimension that's added when you have McKissick or ProSize in the backfield and have the ability to split them out wide against a linebacker. We saw ProSize get a big play at the end of the first half in Tennessee that way. We saw McKissick catch, that was a touchdown pass, right? That way last week.
Which they seem to understand. They seem to understand the value of receiving running backs. They just also, for some reason, really like the idea of running from a heavy offense.
There are probably some conflicting opinions within the Seahawks, you know, headquarters that are probably part of this. But, you know, Danny Kelly, I tweeted this out during the game from the Pelton Cast account, but Danny Kelly had written last week about the value of what he called airbacks, these running backs who are really effective as receivers. And it was sad. We also saw Chris Carson, by the way, make a big catch on third down, just split out wide. But the matchups that you can create by splitting them out of the backfield and allowing them to run routes one-on-one against linebackers when it's someone who's got a wide receiver background like McKissick or like ProSize, that can be a huge edge for you. And that's not something you should just use on third down. It should be also a weapon on first and second down.
Yes.
And so, we saw them just line up and run the ball effectively with McKissick.
So we saw the offense by spreading out a little bit more, opening things up a little bit more, doing a much less heavy set running offense. I think we got a little bit closer to seeing what this offense looks like when it's good.
For sure. I mean, it's an idealized version of the Seahawks offense, and we knew that it was in
there. They still ran the ball. You know, it's not that they didn't run
the ball.
No, and
they ran the ball effectively. like Eddie Lacy came in and averaged, you know, over four, solidly over 4 yards per carry. His DVOA is still terrible, weirdly, but it looked good. It was nice to see that, again, that capability is still there, because I thought it was going into the season, and it's nice to see it happen. And we still haven't seen it with Thomas Rawls, so at some point we're going to have to see that with him.
Yeah. Goddamn, Russell's good, though.
I mean, ugh. The throw going to his left, rolling out to his left to Tyler Lockett.
That was the Lockett throw?
Yeah.
So good. I mean, were either of the interceptions, I couldn't remember, there was one that I think bounced off Jimmy's hands, right?
Yes.
And what was the other one?
Died.
That was the second half anymore. Interception was the one that bounced off Jimmy's hands on the sideline. What? I can't remember the other interception.
No, I think the Graham interception was in the first half.
Okay.
I mean, look, it doesn't matter. He was making great decisions throughout the entire game, and you know, the overall stat line reflects that. I was going to tweet, like, we don't deserve Russell Wilson after that play where it turned out his knee was down. There was several plays like that, obviously, but the one where he flips the ball to Luke Wilson like a 20-yard pickup, which was such a bummer because what an amazing play it was nonetheless, despite the fact that his knee was in fact down. But then it got turned around where it turned out his knee was not down on that touchdown run. And how awesome to see Russell Wilson, like, so emotional and excited after that touchdown.
Fuck yeah.
Again, we're saving the profanity for tomorrow.
Sorry,
this
okay.
Pod. Let's see. Anything else takeaways from that game? Well, we haven't the other injury we haven't talked about is Cliff Avril.
Yeah, so let's run through the injuries because there were numerous. Let's start with Chris Carson, though. Well, just Chris Carson and then also replacing him.
I think we kind of discussed that, didn't we?
Oh, God.
What else is there to say?
Okay, but so as far as replacing Chris Carson, I was saying to you how ridiculous it is that the Seahawks have Thomas Rawls, who they inexplicably consider to be the starting running back. They went out and signed Eddie Lacy, who's getting paid $4.5 million.
I think so.
And we're devastated that the 7th-round draft pick is injured.
Yes.
But it's like, you look at it, and I still maybe a little bit believe that Eddie Lacy can kind of be the feature back, and with potentially CJ Procise and JD McKissick as third-down backs or changes of pace, I think that the Seahawks can still put together a pretty good running back committee.
I think they can put together an adequate running back
it's
committee.
It's insane. This is Chris Carson. Like, I mean, this is a 7th-round draft pick that they lost.
It's not that they don't have the talent. It's just that, I don't trust them to use Procise and McKissick as much as they should now that they have more injury insurance for Procise, and you don't have to worry about, you know, his durability as much.
And then Reese Odhiambo, on one of the interception returns, gets hit in his chest,
and suffered a bruised sternum that created some difficulty breathing, but sounds like it's not, you know.
He sounds like a Tom Petty song. He's got a broken heart.
It turned out not to have a heart contusion, is was initially a cardiac contusion. Is was
I like that so much better, bruised heart.
No, it was much worse.
Well, it's much worse than like injury, but you know, as far as the poeticness of it.
I'm not concerned about that, I gotta be honest with you. So there's a chance, it sounds like, that Odhiambo might play. We'll probably know more when Pete Carroll meets the media later this week.
It's a little bit unclear, but how do you feel about, let's say it's Matt Tobin who's at left tackle?
I mean, Odhiambo had a better game, it seemed like, on Sunday, but I don't think that it would be impossible to replace his production.
It's like we're looking at it and you're like, the percentage difference between Reese Odhiambo and George Fant is he 75% as good? We don't really know, because we don't really know what George Fant is. Is Matt Tobin 90% of what Reese Odhiambo was?
Yeah. And then Cliff Avril with the neck injury, which seems to be a bit mysterious. It seems like a more severe form of a stinger where he was having inability to control his arm, I believe. So that's certainly worrisome. And the Seahawks signing Quentin Jefferson, who was on the roster last year, was a draft pick last year, back to the roster to
double
fill
agent
that,
Quentin Jefferson.
To fill that roster spot freed up by putting Chris Carson on IR, certainly indicates that they expect him to miss some time.
And it's good that the Seahawks have so much depth in the pass rush. And I think we finally saw Frank Clark kind of be what we were expecting him to be this year.
We finally saw the pass rush as a whole be what we were expecting it to be.
They were good against Green Bay.
They were pretty good. Sheldon Richardson was really good. I think the one big takeaway that I had, by the way, about Sunday's game, and specific to the pass rush, is just how much different a team the Seahawks are when they're playing from ahead.
Yes.
And which is ironic because of the fact that they have such a tough time getting started quickly. They're a team, no team benefits more from starting quickly than the Seahawks, and yet they just can't do it. So hopefully that'll continue to happen. It definitely is an issue in terms of depth at the very least.
Depth is a huge issue. I mean, being able to go and pluck Quentin Jefferson's not bad. Somebody who already knows the system.
But he's not that style of player.
Still a pretty promising player. I like it.
I like him. Marcus Smith flash in with that sack.
Marcus Smith too. I think the D-line will be okay. Let's be honest about Cliff Avril.
He was the best defensive line. He was the best defensive end on the team last year with Michael Bennett's
but
injuries.
But still, I mean, how old is Cliff Avril?
I just think depth is very important on the defensive
line. Depth is important, but you still have, as far as pass rushing type players, Bennett, Richardson, Frank Clark looked really good, and Marcus Smith.
Yeah, we'll see how consistent Marcus Smith can be. If he steps up, that really is a game changer.
But I really like the comparison that they had with Marcus Smith as Chris Clemens when he was coming over.
That seems optimistic.
Like, they're good at molding pass rushers.
I mean, they haven't done it. No, I guess Frank Clark.
Done it quite a bit, all things considered.
And it depends how highly you think of Cassius Marsh, I guess. Oh, Bruce Irvin.
Bruce Irvin, Frank Clark, Michael Bennett, and Cliff Avril, who were not necessarily considered elite pass rushers. Chris Clemens before them.
I mean, I think they just got lucky that it was a year where the free agent market was wonky with pass rushers, and it was the right time for it for the Seahawks.
Still.
And then the last injury would be Jeremy Lane, who came out of this with a groin injury and looks like he'll probably miss some time. And it's interesting because as well as Shaquille Griffin has played this season, it seemed like he got picked on a bit more against Indianapolis. It was probably his weakest performance, I think, so far this season, and probably not coincidental with the fact that he was on the field as much as he was.
I like Justin Coleman, though.
Justin Coleman's great.
Love man. Justin Coleman.
And I mean, again, Shaq Griffin's going to
really the Patriots. Maybe they could use Justin Coleman.
It just it does seem a little bit that way, doesn't it? Especially if he could rush the passer. Yeah, I mean, I think the Seahawks would be okay there, although they may get tested a little bit this week.
Oh, God.
In the secondary.
What is happening?
It's a showdown for the NFC West, and the team that is leading the division at 3-1, the LA Rams, the high-flying, high-scoring LA Rams, fresh off going into AT&T Stadium and beating the Cowboys.
How did that happen?
It didn't seem like it was going
to
happen.
Boggles the mind. Happen. Okay, so we need to start with Jared Goff. Last year was one of the worst quarterbacks in NFL history. I mean, we looked at Jared Goff and said to ourselves, there's almost no history of quarterbacks who have been that bad and become good quarterbacks. And in 1 year, Sean McVay has worked his magic and Jared Goff is now.
So I think it's a combination of things. And it starts, number one, with the investment they made in the offensive line this year, going out and signing Andrew Whitworth, which, you know, seemed a little crazy. Andrew Whitworth was, what, 34, 35?
Yeah.
Signing that old of a player to what looked like a rebuilding team. Like, how does this make any sense? But now all of a sudden they're a contender, not a rebuilding team, and it's made a huge difference. So last year, Jared Goff was sacked on 11.3% of his dropbacks, which is just a preposterous amount. This year, that is down to 3.3%, barely a quarter of that number.
Andrew Whitworth playing all five positions on the line?
Yeah. I mean, the Seahawks maybe should look into that if he's capable of doing it. His completion percentage, Jared Goff, is up from 54.6% to 66.7%.
Unbelievable.
And his yards per completion is up from 9.7, which is not terrible, to 13.7, which is tops in the NFL.
Jesus Christ.
And his interception percentage has gone down from 3.4% to less than 1%, 0.9% of his passes so far this year. Now, here's the interesting thing. Jared Goff's number one in the NFL in DVOA by Football Outsiders, but he's only 10th in QBR, the ESPN quarterback ranking, and that's interesting. So why the difference here? He's one spot, by the way, ahead of Russell Wilson, who's like 20th in DVOA. Part of that is running, of course, but the other factor is yards. He's benefited a lot from yards after the catch in the design of the St. Louis offense. Todd Gurley, who has all of a sudden become a pass-catching threat, which he never was before. He is fourth in the NFL with 138 of his 234 yards after the catch, and Sammy Watkins, 78 of his 211 yards have come after the catch.
Man.
So a lot of this is about the design and putting playmakers in space. And here's the number one thing I think that Sean McVay has done, more than anything else. He stopped throwing the ball to Tavon Austin.
Yes.
Like, what he did, sort of. But they've sort of swapped Tavon Austin and Todd Gurley in a way where before Todd Gurley was just slamming into the line repeatedly for like 3 yards as a Todd Gurley fantasy owner last year.
Yes.
I know how often he did that. And they were throwing the ball to Tavon Austin, who's not good at catching passes or regaining yards when he does catch them. So this year, Tavon Austin has 14 carries for 81 yards. A solid average is basically, he's basically a running back now, but he only has 5 targets all season. He still has been really terrible on those 5 targets.
So weird.
And then Todd Gurley, who previously, he's, you know, his running game, he's been okay as a runner, good but not great. He's averaging 4.2 yards per carry, and he's 12th in DVOA, right behind Chris Carson. And this is where we get sad again. But he's number two in receiving DR among running backs. He's caught 20 of his 25 targets for 234 yards and three touchdowns. Sammy Watkins, who they traded for in the preseason, has caught 14 of 16 passes thrown his way for 211 yards or 13.2 yards per target.
Does Sherm cover, does he follow Sammy Watkins?
Nah, I don't think so. If he didn't follow, if he didn't follow T.Y. Hilton last week, he's probably not going to follow Sammy Watkins.
What if it's an issue?
I mean, I think, first off, the guy you're counting on to stop Sammy Watkins is Earl Thomas.
Okay.
You know, he's not running a lot of precise comeback routes or that sort of thing to beat a cornerback one-on-one with a great thrown ball.
And how have the Seahawks been? They haven't faced that many running backs who come out of the backfield so far this year. I mean, Ty Montgomery hasn't really
been
a receiving back.
They've been really good against,
so they have still,
tight ends. They've been bad against wide receivers.
They've been a little bit weaker about running backs coming out of the backfield.
They've been up and down, I would say. And then the other threat they have, the aforementioned Cooper Kupp from Eastern Washington, drafted in, what, the second or third round this year. And he is, so Watkins is number one among wide receivers in DVOA. Cooper Kupp is number four.
Man.
He's got 14 of 21 passes thrown his direction for 186 yards. So this is a lot of threats they've got now all of a sudden. And Sean McVay is putting them in the right place and making the most of them. So I think what's fascinating about the Rams is, you know, if I would have told you before the season, if I would have come into the live show as Kevin Domas and told you, hey, the Rams are going to start the season 3-1, and they're going to be one of the hottest teams in football. They're going to be number three in Football Outsiders, like, projections going forward, right ahead of the Seahawks. You would have said, oh, man, the Rams defense finally got it together yes. under Wade Phillips. And yet that's not the case. Like, no. their defense hasn't been bad. It's been basically identical to the Seahawks defense so far, both in terms of overall DVOA. The Seahawks are 14th and the Rams are 13th. And then also in kind of the splits between those, where the Rams, their pass rush has been pretty good. That fearsome pass rush, the third in adjusted sack rate, although they're really doing it by committee. So far, it hasn't necessarily been about Aaron Donald and Robert Quinn, the stars on the defensive line. They only have 2.5 combined sacks, but they have 9 different players with at least one sack. Connor Barwin, who came over as a free agent from Philadelphia, and then Matt Longacre, who's been a reserve who hasn't played that much for them the last couple of years. They both have 2 sacks to lead the team so far this year. They've struggled a little bit with running backs, and tight ends have been very effective generally covering wide receivers, which is a surprise given their talent in the secondary. But where this team has struggled defensively is stopping the run. They're 24th in defensive DVOA against the run, and opposing running backs are averaging 5 yards per carry against them so far. They've actually been pretty good in short yardage situations, which I think backs up the fact that they've got this stout defensive line with Donald and Quinn, but they really struggle when opponents are able to get to the second level. Not quite as badly as the Seahawks have struggled when opponents got to the second level, but almost. They're 29th in open field yards.
But also, the Seahawks are so good at getting to the second level.
Yeah, that's exactly what they specialize in. So we'll see if they can take advantage of that, but this is a game where you may want to run the ball a little bit more, given that pass rush and given their struggles against the run.
So do you think there's a chance that this game, we have in our head what a Seahawks versus Rams game looks like, and it's not pretty.
Oh, you got to throw it out.
Do you think there's a chance that this game looks a little bit different than those historical games that we've seen so many times?
Well, I mean, there's no question it's going to look different. The Rams are going to score points. This is going to be a much higher scoring game than, you know, what was the final last year at the Coliseum here? I've got the...
We don't think it's going to be like a 10-7 game, a 10-6 game, a game where...
A 9-3 game.
9-3. Who was it who lost that fumble? Was it Alex Collins or Kristen Michael?
I don't remember.
Well, one of those two.
You know, Alex Collins has some fumbling issues, though. In 24-3, the score at CenturyLink Field. Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, here's the most optimistic thought I have about this game.
Yes.
The Seahawks always struggled to beat the Rams on the road when the Rams were terrible.
Yes.
What if now that the Rams are good, they can't beat the Seahawks?
New Rams.
That's the hope.
But to me, I look at the Rams offense, right? And they've played very well. But the one time that they've played a pretty good defense in Washington, they scored 20 points at home, which, given their defense, doesn't necessarily guarantee you a win. I think if they score 20 points in this game, I think the Seahawks win this one, right?
That's optimistic.
But they've played Indianapolis, San Francisco, and Dallas, all three of whom have bottom 10 defenses by DVOA.
I saw that San Francisco was really good defensively in week two. Yeah, I mean, you know, they did give up 39 points to San Francisco, so they
so they've played three very bad defenses, and they've done well against them. But they also played Washington and did okay, but lost at home to a team that looks like maybe a pretty good team, but not, you know, not the best in the league.
So another interesting thing is, I mentioned the difference between QBR and DVOA and Jared Goff.
Yeah.
It's sort of matched, and maybe even more extreme, by the difference between how Football Outsiders rates the Rams overall. And I mentioned, you know, their forward-looking projections, what they call Dave, when they did that movie about the president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have the Rams third in the league behind the ahead of the Seahawks in fourth. The ESPN Football Power Index projections still have the Rams as below 500 team.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow!
Because their projection going into the season was so low, it hasn't been able to raise up enough.
They're probably overrating their preseason projection there, though.
I mean, I think the answer probably lies somewhere in between those extremes.
Yes.
I would assume that they're probably not the third best team in the league, but they're probably not like the 20th best team in the league.
But I just look at it and I'm like, I understand why the Rams are favored, but God, what bulletin board material for the Seahawks. They're going in there. The Rams are favored against them. This is a team that had Jared Goff as their starting quarterback. Look, the Seahawks have had a hard time in there, but now all of a sudden they should maybe be able to score against...
Maybe.
Against the Rams.
I mean, the pass rush is still an issue, by the way.
But can they spread it out a little bit? Can they pass the ball? Can they do things a little bit differently? The Seahawks have shown in... two consecutive second halves that they can be
a good
offense.
And we saw how well that Tennessee defense followed it up in Houston, yes, when they allowed 57 points to the Texans.
But they've shown in two consecutive second halves that they understand what it takes to be a good offense.
So the other thing we haven't discussed here.
Yes.
If there's been one constant of the Rams dating back to St. Louis in LA, they've been bad at a lot of things. A lot of things. But they have been really good at special teams. Under John Fossil, who coached the last three games of the season.
Is he still the special teams coordinator?
He is still the special teams coordinator. And again, they are very good. They're number four in Football Outsiders DVOA on special teams. The Seahawks are 23rd. Their kicker, Greg Zuerlein, a perfect 14 of 14 this season, including 7 of 7 last Sunday.
That's
and
good.
He's 8 of 8 from beyond 40 yards, which is weird because I don't think he was previously actually all that good. And then Johnny Hecker, traditionally either the best or second best punter in the league, perennially among the top punters. The Seahawks, besides struggling with punt coverage, they have had the worst, like, what Football Outsiders calls hidden value, which is basically like special teams luck. Right. It's the length of other teams' kickoffs, the length of their punts. What was there, a 62-yarder by Rigoberto Sanchez last week?
It feels like they have not been able to get anything in special teams going.
And opponents making field goals. So they've had the worst luck of any team in the NFL on special teams. And that's probably not going to change this week. And I think that could be a key differentiator in this game.
Well, I really hope it doesn't come down to that.
Me too.
It's weird because I'm looking at this Rams game. I know what a Seahawks-Rams game means, but to me, this feels different.
Got
to
throw it out the window. Sean McVay's here. He's young. He's not Jeff Fisher. He's
not doing it that way. Look, Jeff Fisher could beat the Seahawks any day of the week.
He could, but there was also a lot of 7-9 bullshit.
This feels
still
like
miss you, Jeff Fisher.
It feels like it's going to be a different game than the Seahawks-Rams games that we've seen over and over and over again. I mean, honestly, I'm basically just fascinated to watch, but I do think that the Seahawks will be able to score points in this one.
I am terrified to watch, for one, and while you seem to be taking an optimistic tack, I am going the opposite direction.
Wow.
My chances of victory for this game are like 30%. I think the Seahawks are doomed. I think the Rams are good.
I think they're less than 50%, but I don't think they're that low.
You just objected to the Rams being favored by a point and a half. So what do you have them at, like 48?
I think they're like I'm going to go 45%. I object to the Rams being, I'm not even necessarily objecting to that myself, because look, we've seen a lot of Rams games. We know they should be favored in LA. I'm saying that from the Seahawks perspective, I don't think they look at the Rams and say to themselves, this is a team that's on our level.
Well, that may have been some of the problem the last few years, why they kept losing to them. And so hopefully they will see them is on their level at this point.
I think it's going to come down a lot to the pass rush. And if the pass rush for LA is dominant, then it's going to come down to, can the Seahawks take what they've done the last couple weeks in the second half and kind of neutralize that pass rush a little bit? Use JD McKissick as an airback. Get Doug Baldwin open quickly, get the ball out quickly, and get Russell Wilson into space. Or if they catch Russell Wilson when he's scrambling, then it's going to be a long game.
This is all a little more optimistic than I'm willing to be. I see, you know, the Seahawks falling behind because of the way the Rams can score, and then
you're
that puts the pass rush into play.
Offense. Let's be clear here. This is four games.
It's four games.
This is not a full season. Yeah, no. The Rams have not faced a defense. Look,
but the Seahawks aren't a good defense. That's part of the problem here.
Let's cool off.
The Seahawks
off
had a great second half against the Colts.
Let's cool off for a second, half on the Seahawks the not
they're
being a good defense.
They're the 14th ranked defense by DVOA. They gave up, I mean, they haven't given up a lot of points.
History still matters here. You want to talk about an FBI or whatever. History still matters. This is a good defense.
It's probably a good defense. I'm just not completely sold.
They've played one solid half in each of the games they played. Maybe against the 49ers, they were good the entire game. But I'm not willing to look at the Seahawks defense yet and say that the Rams are definitely going to score on them. You're talking about a very bad offense last year versus a very good defense for the last 7 years. And all of a sudden, you're throwing everything out from four games. That's how much you believe in sample size?
That's how much I believe in Sean McVay.
Come on. They've beaten Sean McVay before.
Has the Seahawks beaten Sean McVay before?
Yeah, wasn't he the coordinator in Washington?
I don't know if he was the coordinator yet the last time. I mean, the last time they played them was, what, 3 years ago? It was a long time ago, wasn't it?
I'm just like, Sean McVay, you millennials over there. And your belief in Sean McVay, like, Sean McVay
is such a borderline millennial at best. I guess he was the offensive coordinator in 2014 when the Seahawks beat them 27-17. So
they've never seen anything like Earl Thomas before. They have not played against a pass rush as good as the Seahawks pass rush, even without Cliff Avril yet. You are going too far. And maybe it turns out to be an old school Rams game where it's a close game, but this is not going to be the Rams dominate on offense.
We'll see.
Man, you're making me more confident. By being negative.
You're making me more pessimistic. It's great.
Okay, percentage chances of victory.
We just did that, remember?
But
no, I told you, 30%.
Okay, and I'm going 45?
Yeah.
Also, I think the Seahawks can win this game.
What if it's a hot day in LA? Which it often is. I haven't looked up what the weather is. I don't know if you're aware of this.
The Seahawks can't play in the rain or in the
heat. It's a very limited amount of weather.
I think it's pretty solid if it's like kind of gray.
I think eventually they'll be able to play in the rain. It's just they couldn't because of the fact that it hadn't rained in Seattle yet to that point.
What if it's a hot day in LA? Then they're screwed. They might as well not even play him.
Seriously. All right. On that note, we'll know a lot more about the Seahawks this time the next week, I think.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.